When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the New Books Network. This is Shu Wan. Today, I feel very happy to invite Dr. Landon Dorfer to introduce his newest book, Utopian Past and the Future in a Contemporary American Novel. So the first question today from me is that I want to invite Dr. Landon Dorfer to introduce himself to us.
I'll happily do that. Hey, my name is Tim Lanzendorfer. I am currently a research professor of American Studies at Goethe University in Frankfurt in Germany. And I work on topics in contemporary literary theory and contemporary literature and in contemporary, what I call literary studies education, which is like, what does literary studies actually do in the world?
Okay, thanks so much for your brief self-introduction. For next question, I'm wondering why you're interested in studying utopia, this very interesting topic, in American literature.
I think there's like two answers to that, at least. The first answer to that is it's because it's a topic that's out there. It's a topic that has actual material to it, I was going to say, right? There's a lot of books out there that are, if you look at it from the vantage point that I propose in the book, very utopian. I think you have to have a particular lens towards them in order to understand how utopian they are. But they are very clearly, to my mind, utopian fictions, very hopeful thinking about what the future might bring. And I think the second answer to the same question would be to say it's a bit of a counterweight to what's far more prevalent in discussions, which is dystopian fiction, right? Most people have a sense of what fiction is out there that produces dystopian ideas of the future, most prominently in the last like decade or so, something like The Hunger Games. And this is a counterweight to that, in a way. It is to say, there's a lot of stuff out there that's not actually thinking this in totally dystopian terms, but offers hopeful thinking of the future.
Okay, thanks so much for your answer. So I really appreciate the answer. I want to say, especially as a historian, a American historian, I totally agree with you that, okay, this utopia is a big issue throughout American history so far. So now, then let's turn to your book. So for the book, my first question is that I want to invite you to talk about the use of idea of vision in the critique of idea of transnationalism in the novel Equilateral.
Yeah, I can hear. Maybe let me preface this by saying something important about the book, right? The book's vision of utopia is always a vision that takes in a historical dimension. So I'm interested in hearing from you as a historian, right, that this is something you also see. Because what the book's after, basically, is it tries to present to you the idea that there is such a thing as what I call speculative historism, which is a historical imagination that is always tied to a speculative imagination. Texts which have some form of either placement in history or have a decidedly historical sense of their own position, if you like, right? So it always combines the sense of what a historical perspective brings to our thinking about hope for the future. That's its major goal. It wants to say, hey, what these texts all do is they utilize historical moments or, in fact, history as such as a avenue of thinking through utopian ideas. So here's the idea of what's happening in Equilateral. Equilateral is a 2013 novel by a writer named Ken Kalfas. And what it does, it's set in a pre-World War I Egypt. And in that pre-World War I Egypt, a conglomerate of international nations, tries to build a huge equilateral triangle in the desert because the people in this novel believe that there is, in fact, a civilization on Mars that is communicating with them. And that civilization on Mars must, these people think, be extremely advanced technologically because it must be old and it must have insights into what life could look like in the future of Earth. And the major issue that these competing interests in the novel have is whether or not you can make this into an idealist venture, if you like, if you can draw actual sort of life lessons for society from that, which is what the protagonist of the novel basically comes around to, or whether it's just a commercial interest, whether it's just a thing that will let Earth build better stuff or sell more stuff to the Martians, right? So it's in this kind of field of competing interpretations of what Mars could mean that Equilateral thinks through the idea of transnationalism. And transnationalism, of course, used to be a very, very hyped topic like 12, 15, 20 years back. It's kind of gone by the wayside a little bit. But what Equilateral does is basically take this idea of transnationalism and put it under a microscope. And I say in the book that what I say critique here is basically a question of the possibilities of this object transnationalism, right? It's basically a Kantian fundamental critique of what would it mean to think about transnationalism. And Equilateral has an answer, right? It has this answer that it's difficult because the kinds of projects that seem to promise some sense of utopian hope, which is part of what this Equilateral triangle production is, are also the kinds of projects that are definitely commercial, that are definitely to be understood in a sort of globalization kind of sense of transnationalism. And it doesn't come up with a good answer to sort of where is the moral or ethical grounds for transnationalism, because it understands that some of our thinking about this, right? Some of our thinking, for instance, in an ethically positive way, such as cosmopolitanism, are basically undergirded by economical issues, and they're financed by interests that don't have your best interests at heart, but want to make more money. And that's the basis of its critique.
Okay. Thank you so much for your answer. So for the next question, this is about your second chapter of your book. I would like to invite you to talk about the two major ideas in your novel, The Accursed. The hope of one is the hopeful possibility enacted by a new view of history. Second one is a break with the past. And I'm wondering how they will connect with the utopian socialism.
Yeah. So my second book, the second chapter of the book, all the chapters in the book are basically very extensive close readings of very concrete examples of versions of what I call speculative historism. And my second book is a thick novel by Joyce Carol Oates that's called The Accursed. And The Accursed is set around 1905, 1906. And what it does is it immediately draws up this vision of utopian socialism as one version of how to think the future, because one of its protagonists is, in fact, Upton Sinclair, whom we best know as the writer behind The Jungle, the 1905-6 also socialist novel, and who will come to, in 1907, actually produce a utopian socialist community, the Helicon Home Colony. So he's a protagonist. And what the novel does throughout is basically situate this moment of socialist hope against its other protagonists' very, very deeply upper middle class, if not upper class, backgrounds. It's set in Princeton, New Jersey, at Princeton University. It has a whole host of historical figures appearing there. And it's written as the historical narrative by one of the people who was not completely there yet, because he was only going to get born in the course of the novel, but one of the people who in 1905 were sort of personally involved, because his parents were personally involved in a fantastical episode where it turns out that the family behind the major protagonist of the novel, so not Upton Sinclair, were in fact, or maybe not in fact, that's the fantastical aspect to the novel, plagued by a demon force from the outside. And many of the things that are, to our understanding, historical ills, which include something like the dominance of a very, very detached upper class, which include misogyny, which include racism, which include homophobia, are coded in the novel as being, at least in part, due to that demon infestation. And what the novel does, finally, is it reads one of the characters explicit coming free from his historical misdeeds, right? He's a preacher, and he gives a sermon in which he admits that he was part of a lynch mob and that he had raped a black woman 50 years before, right? And he comes free of that, and with that, in parallel, right, this curse is lifted. So what the novel does, or one of the things that it does, and the one thing that I'm sort of focusing on, is to think through how this revision of history, which is both the novel's revision of a previous sort of fictional history, as well as the novel's own revision of this 1905 moment, how that brings forth, through the explicit break with the past, a new way of thinking about the possibilities of the future. And it does connect that with utopian socialism, as I said, right, through Upton Sinclair, but also because you cannot, or I could not anyway, help but see how interested the novel is in thinking in those socialist utopian terms. Now, with writers such as George Carol Oates, it's never quite clear sort of if there's an authorial intentionality here, right? If he sort of wants to avow this socialism. But the novel, I think, clearly does. The novel very clearly avows this kind of socialism. And here it's very interesting, at least to me, that this used to be part of a large writing project that Oates was after in the early 1980s. And she never published this novel with its avowed socialist perspective in the 1980s, right? And there's this entire tie to the early mid-1980s just were not a moment of hope, of utopian hope for anybody. It really took something like the upheavals in the economy and in our thinking about the economy of the mid-2000s, right, the Great Recession, for instance, to make this novel come through again. So she publishes this in 2009, and it works in 2009 in a way that maybe it didn't in 1984, right? So this entire horizon of thinking about how literature finds its place and what kinds of things it can usefully avow at what historical moment.
Yes. Okay, thanks so much for your answer again. So now let's turn to the third chapter of the book. It's interesting, in this chapter, you talk about two books. One is Chris Batchelder's book, Novel, and Jason Hill's novel, Tufts, in 2012. So here is my question. I'm wondering why you talk about the difference and the similarity between the two novels when speculating American politics.
Yeah. The book does this twice, right? I twice talk about two novels. And the reason I talk about two novels in two separate chapters is that in both of those chapters, the juxtaposition is, I thought, instructive of how to imagine versions of how to relate to history. What both of these novels share is the bodily return of a historical figure. In the case of Chris Batchelder's U.S., that is Upton Sinclair again, right? This is also why this comes after the Accursed, basically. It's the connection. In U.S., Upton Sinclair becomes something like the avatar of a past historical imagination on the left that still thought that there was the possibility of some sort of socialist success, socialist victory, right? But in U.S., it also becomes clear that this is, in parts, a difficult hope, because it bodily brings back Upton Sinclair from, like, 1936 or whenever Upton Sinclair died, repeatedly, right? He gets resurrected every 10 or so years, and every time he gets basically to be the focal point of the left's energies and their interest. And what he does is he writes terrible novels, as Upton Sinclair historically, did, quote unquote, right? Terrible in the sense that they're not very literary. They're very, very sort of pamphlety kind of writing. Nobody apparently is interested but the moribund American left of each of these historical moments. But what happens still is that this socialist utopian hope does remain alive, right? It is ridiculous in many ways. It is ridiculed in many ways, not just sort of semi-ironically by the novel itself, but by many of the characters in there. But what all this ridicule cannot detract from is that it does retain this sense of there is another version of life out there, and people might be willing to accede to that version of life. U.S. has a sort of minimal utopian moment at its end, where a single person, a single child, 13 or 14 years old, reads one of Upton Sinclair's novels, his very latest novel, in fact, and gets converted to the socialist cause, to the socialist idea. And that's basically against the sort of the oppressive mass of everything that the novel says cannot be done. This single glimpse of, but yet it works, right? Yet it produces sort of people who can think the future differently. And it does that specifically, I think, by offering up socialism as a different view of how the world might work. And the reason why that's interesting, sort of with comparison to Jason Heller's Taft 2012, is that Taft 2012 also has an avatar, a historical avatar. That's William Howard Taft, the 1906 to 1908, 1912 president of the United States, who in this novel disappears in 1912 and reappears in 2012 on the White House lawn and becomes himself sort of the avatar of a different sense of politics. But what this politics entails is basically soft left liberalism, soft progressivism, soft kind of wouldn't it be better if we all got along kind of rhetoric. And it basically stops there, right? This novel never comes through with a vision of what a good politics would actually look like. It never has the sort of ideological undergirding, because it essentially just wants to say people are looking for somebody to represent their hopes for a sort of agreement in principle, but no change. What they don't want is any sort of radical shift in how the world works. They want to get along better. And the novel sort of doesn't make that work. And I argue that part of why it doesn't work is that it cannot work. It's just visionless, if you will, right? So the juxtaposition of these two novels basically is used in my book to say, this is how the historical version, the historical imagination can work. And that's Upton Sinclair and US, when you have an actual thing to hold on to, a concrete ideological promise. And it doesn't work when you don't. And the juxtaposition produces that kind of insight for the book.
Yeah, so much for your answer again. So now let's turn to the fourth chapter of the book. So for this chapter, my question is that I want to invite you talk about how Ready Player One, the novel, works through the transformation of escapism into activism, of a retreat into fantasy, into an emancipatory act, and produce a vision for a better future.
Yeah, it's like there's two. If the question is posed like that, there's two answers to this. The first answer to that is, why do I do that? Because Ready Player One is an immensely non-literary novel, if you want. And one of the parables I say that runs through the book is to say we can address ourselves to very literary fiction. That is to say, very high cultural, sort of avowedly difficult even kind of text. And that starts with kind of Kalthus, right, who is nothing but a literary writer. And here in the middle of the book, in chapter 4, we come to sort of the top of a parable that says we can talk about progressively less literary things, progressively more kind of blockbustery, genre textual things. And Ready Player One is not a complicated book. It's very easy to read. It's very straightforward in what it argues, at least on the surface, is what I'm saying. And it's been frequently, and especially in the wake of the adaptation, the Steven Spielberg film adaptation, it's been derided as banal and maudlin and trite and that kind of stuff. Right. So the reason I wanted to talk about it is that I argue that my claim about utopian reading of utopian hermeneutics, kind of bringing forth the utopian vision of those texts, works with a text as completely uncomplicated as Ready Player One. So for those of you who don't know what Ready Player One is, Ready Player One is a basically near future history, basically dystopian, in which most of everything that's worth doing has been relegated to a online space that's called the Oasis. So people go to school in the Oasis, people work in the Oasis, people do not basically live in the real world anymore. The real world, such as it is terrible. There's wide wastelands between major cities. There's what the novel calls stacks, where like trailers get stacked into large high rises because you can't afford any other way of living anymore. And then in that context, it turns out that there is a quest structure going on, because if you follow the exploits of one of the founders of the Oasis, it's possible that you win a game. You hunt for the, basically for dominance of the Oasis. If you win a game in the Oasis, which is basically a struggle to answer quiz questions and sort of find keys and do like online gaming stuff, you may become the ruler, the owner anyway, of the Oasis. And we follow the protagonist of the novel through his version of that quest. And unsurprisingly for the novel, right, he wins. He does get to be the ruler of the Oasis. And the question here, to my mind, was how emancipatory, how utopian was that vision? And my answer to this is the major thing that's going on here is a rethinking of escapism, not as a negative thing, but in fact as a version of thinking through much better how you might imagine the imagination itself, right? Imagination isn't escape into a unavailable better future, but here it becomes coded explicitly as an avenue towards a better future, right? The escapism of this video gaming space becomes de facto the only available source for a hopeful future. And the novel is very ambivalent about where it wants to sit at the end, I think. It doesn't really sort of say this video gaming space is bad or is good. It just is, and it's just part of how to think about this potential future life, right? It's inescapable in that sense, but it's not terribly bad escapism in the sense that we usually use escapism. It is, in fact, a space where communal action can produce hopeful results for the world at large.
Thanks so much for your answers. For our next question, I'm wondering about your very interesting arguments in chapter 5 of your book, that Juno Diaz's novel, The Brief Wanderer's Life of Oscar Wilde, must be read as a speculative historicism seeking to reactivate history as a source for utopian imagination of the future.
Yeah. So in this case, right, we're sort of going back on what I call the sort of a downward spiral, a downward arc of the parabola, right? Juno Diaz's Brief Wanderer's Life of Oscar Wilde won the Pulitzer Prize. It's very much a literary novel, but it's also heavily invested in speculation in many ways. Right? It's on the one hand, it carries as a thematic angle, right, this play with pop cultural artifacts. It's very invested in presenting its characters as savvy about the Lord of the Rings or comics or film and that kind of stuff, right? So it's very much interested in this genre angle itself. And on the other hand, it is a alternative speculative history of the Dominican Republic and of the Dominican diaspora in the United States. Because what it asks us to accede to, I think, is that the way it talks about the Dominican dictator, Rafael Trujillo, throughout as this monster that's best coded through metaphors from The Lord of the Rings or metaphors from comics, right? That is, in fact, an argument about the meaning of speculation of fantasy to our understanding of how history works. So what it does, right, is it presents you this alternative idea of how to conceive of Trujillo and how to conceive of the entirety of the Dominican diaspora, including its various sort of cultural formations, if you like. The novel is very invested in presenting, for instance, Dominican malehood as misogynist, as only ever after sex rather than sort of personal growth or something like that. And it uses that in order to set its protagonist progressively apart from this narrative. Its protagonist, Junior, is in the beginning of the novel, sort of chronology, when he appears, basically the prototypical Dominican male. And he's basically, at least on the surface, we should caveat, He is sort of the thing that the novel as the whole writes itself against. And what it does is it develops this person, this character, Junior, into somebody who actually realizes how to use the medium of fiction in order to offer a sense of how life could be lived differently. And it does that very interestingly because it juxtaposes what on the surface is its fictional fantasy writer, the eponymous Oscar Wilde, right? Oscar Wilde writes a fantasy novel, or wants to write a fantasy novel, rather, because he thinks only a fantasy novel can grasp what Dominican history looks like. And the novel, to my mind, very plainly says that that's actually wrong. Oscar doesn't manage to grasp Dominican reality because Dominican reality is not, in fact, fantastical. It's not a fantasy novel. It is more complicatedly interacting between a history that is real, but that is best grasped through the metaphors of speculation without missing that it is not there for fantasy, right? Trujillo may or may not be a supernatural demon-like presence for Junior, but he can't sort of be determined to be in the way that Oscar wants it to be. So what the novel eventually does, right, it says that its own speculative historism is the only mode by which the growth, the personal growth of Junior can in fact take place. It's his moment of growth to find out that the novel, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde, is the only way of correctly coding the historical moment in which he finds himself. And it's a personal growth moment. It's a utopian moment for Junior, basically, because for Junior, the novel ends by his very, very firm claim that he's a new man. And by his belief that the daughter of his best friend, basically, can come to grow up in a completely different sense of what the Dominican Republic might mean. It's personal, right? But it is utopian. And mostly Oscar Wilde has not been read as a utopian narrative because its ostensible protagonist, the eponymous Oscar Wilde, dies at the end. And I basically say that, no, this is the way that the novel says you can reactivate history for your own personal sort of utopian future.
Thanks so much for your answer again. So for last question today, I'm going to invite you to talk about the representation and the speculation of slavery, the big issue in American history, in Colson Whitehead's Underground Railroad and Ben Winter's Underground Airlines.
Yeah. And I'm happy to do that, but I also have to say a few things, I think, just for my own benefit, as it were, about how I find these two novels sort of to be interesting in different ways. So for both of these novels, right, slavery is the key historical thematic. Both of these novels are basically set in slavery times, although in different ways. And one of my claims here, this is the final chapter of the book, right, and we've done this parabola of how texts think about utopian moments and whether or not it means something that they are genre texts or literary texts, right? Whether there's a difference in their imaginations. And what ends up happening here at the end, basically, is that I'm going to say that Colson Whitehead's The Underground Railroad, which is the first and I think so far only novel to have won both a science fiction prize, the Arthur C. Clarke, as well as the National Book Award and the Pulitzer, brings together these strands of genre writing and of literary writing together in a package that is incredibly successful, even though it is, in many dimensions, not particularly quote-unquote good. And when I say good, I mean in this sort of literary studies, high literature kind of vein. What Whitehead does in this is he writes a very formulaic in the beginning slavery novel. This is a novel that starts on a plantation in the Deep South in presumably something like the 1850s. And it's very, very straightforward about all the things that you sort of want to see, quote unquote, in a slavery novel, right? It has a bad overseer, a terrible owner, right? Slaveholder. Indeed, it has this duel between a more or less good, quote-unquote, again, slave owner and his brother, who's the bad slave owner. It has a slave catcher who is the unalloyed antagonist of the novel. So it begins with that. And then as the protagonist of the novel escapes from this plantation, it shifts into the speculative vein because the major conceit of the novel is that the Underground Railroad, which in history, right, is this network of agents that aid escaped slaves to the north, is not an actual railroad. In this novel, in fact, is an actual underground railroad. So it's a network of tunnels under the Deep South, stretching all the way into Canada, in which actual railroad trains run to bring escaped slaves from the south to the north. And the novel uses this conceit to make these neat little chapters, each of which is basically set in a state, where those southern states also represent states of possibility for American life, essentially, right? There is a quasi-benevolent, quasi-post-slavery situation in North Carolina, for instance. Or is it South Carolina? I don't remember. There is the complete eradication of all Black presence in North Carolina. Yeah, that's the way it goes. And then there's this dystopian future in Tennessee, where there's a plague, an outbreak of the plague, right? And so it has all of these moments of possibility encoded through here. And our protagonist, Cora, finally makes her way north. She succeeds in getting away from slavery. She basically finds her own hopeful space because she reaches a trek that goes west. And what the Underground Railroad does is it presents this dialectic of different historical moments and the presence of this same person, namely Cora, as a quasi version of how to see the possibilities of different ethnic relationships, different relationship between the races in the United States. So I think it's very successful, right? It's very successful. It's won all these awards. It's been a bestseller. Barack Obama really liked it, but it's not very structural, for lack of a better word, because what it doesn't do is it doesn't tell you how to end slavery or deal with slavery in the aftermath or how to think how slavery works in the first place, because it's just a thing that's there and it's just a thing that Cora deals with and wants to escape from. And what the novel ends with is Cora's escape, right? This individualized escape, which is not very satisfying for my reading of the possibilities of this kind of fiction, because as I said, right, most of these other texts have this at least proto-socialist perspective of this, where they go and say there's radical change necessary. So Ben Winters's Underground Airlines, in fact, does produce that kind of an inside. Winters's Underground Airlines is in fact basically pulp fiction. It's like it also makes no pretense to literary high modernist qualities, if you like. But it is very, very invested in thinking through the mechanics of the logistics of slavery. It's set in the contemporary, basically, but it's in an alternative history contemporary where slavery has not, in fact, been completely eradicated from the world, because one of the pre-Civil War compromises actually worked out. And what you are left with is you have five, I'm going to say, states in the Deep South that are still slave-owning, and they're enmeshed in this U.S. economy that, on the one hand, penalizes those economies, right? Some of the northern states, the free states, do not, in fact, trade with the southern states. Others, on the other hand, do. And slavery becomes this overly clearly coded economic structure where the question is never, like, is it good? Is it good? Is it bad? Is there a moral question to slavery? But it is an entirely economic question, right? And the novel is very insistent that it's not for it essentially a question of race at this point, right? It is a question of how are profits made, how are profits produced, as against other versions of making profit. And its answer to slavery then becomes structural, right? The protagonists of that novel do in fact go out and say, we have to fight against the structures undergirding slavery, not sort of for the individual slave in that system, and the way that the Underground Railroad, in fact does. So I'm juxtaposing these two here because they give radically different answers to the question of hope, but they also do, kind of importantly, give radically different answers to the question of like who wants what hope, because nobody by proxy. By proximity anyway, liked Underground Airlines. It's not a bestseller. It's not sort of right there, right? And nobody gave it a prize. The Underground Railroad did. And one of the arguments that I do make in the book is basically that that's because it usefully triangulated an alliance of interests, some of which are very invested in this sort of individualist perspective that Quora's success gives. But that makes it powerful in a way, right? It's not a great novel by any stretch of the imagination, I don't think. It's not even as clever or as intelligent, I don't think, a mediation or meditation, rather, either on blackness or on slavery, as Ben Winters' book is, or even Whitehead's previous novel, Zone One, was, which is much, 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 much cleverer at thinking through ethnicity and race. But it's very successful because it manages to say, hey, this is how you can, in fact, think hope across a broad alliance of interests, none of whom you might want to be able to subscribe, well, you might want, but won't subscribe to socialism. So you give them something different. You tell to them, hey, this is how hope can figure into our thinking with literature. And that's basically it, right? This is the end point of the book. And it is sort of the best example of how speculative historism might, in fact, produce a sense of hope and utopian forebodings from a historical imagination, successful, if not literarily brilliant.
Thanks so much for your answer again. So at the end of our talk, now I want to directly talk to our audience. So hi, listeners. I would appreciate you listen to our podcast, especially Dr. Nathan Dorfer's talk about his fantastic book, Utopian Past and the Futures in the Contemporary American Novel. As I mentioned, I'm a American historian, so from my academic or professional perspective, I would appreciate this book, and I think everybody with interest in either utopian literature, or you may just say, oh, I don't like utopian literature, but I take strong interest in American history and the culture and the literature in a general sense, I highly recommend you read this book and buy a copy from Amazon, from everywhere. It's a fantastic book. It's a must-read book for anyone, for everybody with interest in, as I mentioned, in American literature and the culture. So especially maybe some American audience here, you may say, oh, why I read this book? American, why I read a German scholars or German-based scholars study our American novel? I won't say, you need to read this one, because I'm pretty sure Dr. Lennon Dorfer, because of his background, because his cultural background, academic background, he provided very unique and distinct perspective on utopian past in American literature. So it's a very, very, I would say it's very, very fantastic perspective on the topic of American culture. It's provided, it's quietly different from some American scholars' view of their perception of their own culture. So everybody, if you want to know American culture, American literature, and even just a small topic like utopian idea in American literature, I recommend you to buy a copy of this book. So at the end of our podcast episode today, I want to repeat the title again. Please take notes, or you just type down the title, Utopian Past and the Future in a Contemporary American Novel. So thanks so much for listening to our talk today. Thanks.